Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying systematic theology. And now, here is our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are continuing to talk tonight about angels. As Gladys and I were walking up to the front door this evening, she said to me, "I don't think I've ever heard anybody teach for an hour on angels and demons before." And I said, "Tom said the same thing last week."
"Yeah, that was great."
Gladys said, "I don't even remember a half-hour sermon on it, any less hours and hours," which is what we're in the middle of. We're continuing to talk about the angelos, which is the Greek word that has migrated into the English language as angels. The G sound was harder in the Greek language. When it got into the English language, it became a softer G. Otherwise, these creatures would be called angels, and that would just be confusing. So we refer to them as angels. The Hebrew word is malach. The last book in the Old Testament is called Malachi, Malachi, which means my messenger. And so the root word, whether we're talking angelos or whether we're talking malach, the root word means messenger. And that is a key ingredient of who the angels are and what they do, but the Bible uses several different terms to refer to them. We talked about messenger of God. We talked about the holy ones. We talked about sons of God. We talked about the assembly of the holy ones. In Daniel 4:13, he makes reference to a watcher. So sometimes angels are referred to as watchers. 1 Timothy 5:21 refers to elect or chosen angels. And then we spent some time last week talking about the cherubs, the plural of which is cherubim. And we talked about the seraphs. And the plural for that, of course, is seraphim. We did touch on sons of God, which is language that came out of Job 38, and also the fact that the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy at the end of Job 38, verse 7. But tonight, we're going to get into the living creatures, which we just briefly touched on last week and really didn't have time to dig into at all. So we're going to be spending the majority of the evening in the book of Ezekiel, so turn there. Right at the very top of the book of Ezekiel, because this is the first place that we find this description of these beings around and in front of the throne of God. By the way, they also show up in Revelation 4, 6 to 8. We'll go over there and look at them in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to spend some time in Ezekiel 1, then Ezekiel 9, then Ezekiel 10, because he gives us a pretty complete description of these characters. Chapter 1, verse 1 of the book of Ezekiel. "Now it came about in the 13th year, on the 5th day of the 4th month, while I was by the river Chebar among the exiles, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the 5th of the month, in the 5th year of King Jehoiakim's exile, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar, and there the hand of the Lord came upon him. And as I looked, behold, a storm wind was coming from the north, a great cloud with fire flashing forth continually, and a bright light around it, and in its midst something like glowing metal in the midst of a fire. And within it there were figures resembling four living beings, and this was their appearance. They had a human form. Each of them had four faces and four wings." I'm guessing that's where the human form kind of stopped. Not a lot of four-faced, four-winged creatures walking around here. "Their legs were straight, and their feet were like a calf's hoof." Okay, not exactly human. "And they gleamed like burnished bronze." So they shone. "Under their wings, on their four sides, were human hands, As for the faces and wings of the four of them, their wings touched one another. Their faces did not turn when they moved. Each went straight forward. As for the form of their faces, each had the face of a man. All four had the face of a lion on the right, and the face of a bull on the left, and all four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out above. Each had two touching another being, and two covering their bodies. And each went straight forward. Wherever the spirit was about to go, they would go, without turning as they went. In the midst of the living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, and lightning was flashing from the fire. And the living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning. Now, as I looked at the living beings, behold, there was one wheel on the earth beside the living beings for each of the four of them. The appearance of the wheels and their workmanship was like sparkling beryl. And all four of them had the same form, their appearance and their workmanship being as if one wheel were within another. Whenever they moved in any of the four directions without turning as they moved. As for their rims, they were lofty and awesome, and the rims of all four of them were full of eyes round about. And whenever the living beings moved, the wheels moved with them. And whenever the living beings rose from the earth, the wheels rose also. Wherever the spirit was about to go, they would go in that direction. And the wheels rose close beside them, for the spirit of the living beings was in the wheels. Wherever they went, these went. And whenever those stood still, these stood still. And whenever those rose from the earth, the wheels rose close behind them, for the spirits of the living beings was in the wheels. Now, over the heads of the living beings, there was something like an expanse, like the awesome gleam of crystal extended over their heads. And under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight, one toward the other. Each one also had two wings covering their bodies, on the one side and on the other. And I also heard the sound of their wings, like the sound of abundant waters as they went, like the voice of the Almighty, a sound of tumult, like the sound of an army camp. Whenever they stood still, they dropped their wings. And there came a voice from above the expanse that was over their heads. Whenever they stood still, they dropped their wings. Now above the expanse that was over their heads, there was something resembling a throne, like lapis lazuli in appearance. And on that which resembled a throne, high up was a figure with an appearance of a man. Then I noticed from the appearance of his loins and upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw something like fire, and there was a radiance around him, as the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord, and when I saw it, I fell on my face. I'll bet. And then I heard a voice speaking to me, and he said, Son of man, stand on your feet, that I can speak to you. Now, we don't know a lot about these creatures outside of the description that we're given there. But it is interesting. There is a book by Scroggie, his Guide to the Gospels, where he points out that there are four Gospels and there are four living creatures. And in years past, you've heard me talk about the purpose and the meaning for the different Gospels. In fact, at the beginning of our introduction to the book of Matthew, we talked a little bit about it. several Sundays ago that the four authors of the four Gospels, writing to four different audiences, had four different purposes for their writing, and that Matthew was showing that Jesus is the Messiah, the King of Israel, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, and that Mark was writing that he was the suffering servant, Isaiah's suffering servant, and that Luke was writing that he was the perfect and the ideal man, the Greek ideal. And John was writing that he was God, that he was in fact God incarnate. So Scroggie says that the four faces of the four living beings happen to align with that. And I think there's something to that. For instance, there's the face of a man, which would correspond with Luke, and there's the face of an eagle, which would correspond with John, and there's the face of an ox, which is the sacrificial animal for sin, which would correspond with Mark. And there is the face of a lion, which would be Matthew's gospel and the Lion of the tribe of Judah. That's just fascinating in its own right. I'm not going to make too much of it outside of saying, well, that exists. But it would once again show that God is in absolute control of managing his message as he explains to people what he's about and what his son is about and what his son has come to do. And it again validates the idea that the four gospels that we have here 2,000 years later are the four that God intended for us to have, because there is this correspondence. Turn over to Ezekiel 9. Let's dig in a little deeper and see what else we can find out about these living creatures. Chapter 9 of the book of Ezekiel, and we're going to follow it straight into chapter 10. Then he cried out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, "Draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand." This is not a happy prophecy. "And behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his shattering weapon in his hand, and among them was a certain man clothed in linen with a writing case at his loins, and they went in, and they stood beside the bronze altar. Then the glory of the God of Israel went up from the cherub on which it had been to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed in linen, at whose loins was the writing case. And the Lord said to him, 'Go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the man who sighs and groans over all of the abominations which are being committed in its midst.'" In other words, Jerusalem at this point had become so completely corrupt that Ezekiel is seeing a vision of God's judgment on Jerusalem. But before judgment falls, and this is good to know, God sends out an angel with a marker to mark all the people who actually also are upset about what's happening. The people of God get marked first. This is really good to know that God is like that, whether you're talking about a flood and first he takes eight people and locks them into an ark so that they can endure, or whether you're talking about the time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again, and that God is going to remove his church before that happens. Or whether it's Abraham arguing with God and saying, "Will you destroy Sodom and Gomorrah if there's 50 righteous?" And then he talks them all the way down to 10, and God sends an angel into Sodom to go get Lot and his wife and his family and get them out before the judgment of God falls. So it's good to know that this is consistently how God works, and it does give, I think, more underpinning and confidence to our understanding that God is going to come get his church prior to the time of tribulation being poured out. So this angel is going to go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of all the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in its midst. Also, by the way, that ought to resonate with the book of Revelation, where we read that 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel, are marked in their forehead. Well, that's the same thing that happens back here in Ezekiel. "But to the others, he said in my hearing, 'Go through the city after him and strike, and do not let your eye have pity, and do not spare.'" So before the judgment comes, God marks out the ones that he's going to preserve through the punishment. But look at verse 6, "utterly slay, old men, young men, maidens, little children, and women, but do not touch any man on whom is the mark. And you shall start from my sanctuary. So they started with the elders who were before the temple. And he said to them, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Go out. And thus they went out and they struck down the people in the city. Then it came about as they were striking and I alone was left that I fell on my face and cried out saying, alas, Lord God, art thou destroying the whole remnant of Israel by pouring out thy wrath on Jerusalem? And he said to me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is very, very great. And the land is filled with blood and the city is full of perversion. For they say, the Lord has forsaken the land. And the Lord does not see. But as for me, my eye will have no pity, nor shall I spare, but I shall bring their conduct upon their heads. Then behold, the man clothed in linen, at whose loins was the writing case, reported, saying, I have done just as thou hast commanded me. Chapter 10, verse 1. Then I looked, and behold, in the expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim, something like a sapphire stone in appearance, resembling a throne, appeared above them. And he spoke to the man clothed in linen and said, enter between the whirling wheels under the cherubim and fill your hands with coals of fire from between the cherubim and scatter them over the city. And he entered in my sight. Now the cherubim were standing on the right side of the temple when the man entered, and the cloud filled the inner court, and the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub to the threshold of the temple, and the temple was filled with the cloud, and the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of the Lord. Moreover, the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard as far as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks. And it came about when he commanded the man clothed in linen, saying, take fire from between the whirling wheels, from between the cherubim. He entered and he stood beside a wheel. Then the cherub stretched out his hand from between the cherubim to the fire, which was between the cherubim, and took some and put it into the hands of the one that was clothed in linen, who took it and went out. And the cherubim appeared to have the form of a man's hand under their wings. Then I looked, and behold, four wheels beside the cherubim, one wheel beside each cherub, and the appearance of the wheels was like the gleam of a Tarshish stone. And as for their appearance, all four of them had the same likeness, as if one wheel were within another wheel. When they moved, they went in any of four directions without turning as they went, but they followed in the direction which they faced without turning as they went, and their whole body, their backs and their hands and their wings and their wheels were full of eyes all around, the wheels belonging to all four of them. And the wheels were called in my hearing the whirling wheels, and each one had four faces. The first face was the face of a cherub, the second was the face of a man, the third the face of a lion, and the fourth the face of an eagle. Then the cherubim rose up. They are the living beings that I saw by the river Chebar. Now when the cherubim moved, the wheels would go beside them. Also, when the cherubim lifted up their wings to rise from the ground, the wheels would not turn from beside them. When the cherubim stood still, the wheels would stand still. And when they rose up, the wheels would rise with them, for the spirit of the living beings was in them. Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. And when the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight, with the wheels beside them, and they stood at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel hovered above them. These are the living beings that I saw beneath the God of Israel by the river Chebar, So I knew that they were cherubim. Each one had four faces, and each one had four wings, and beneath their wings was the form of human hands. As for the likeness of their faces, they were the same faces whose appearance I had seen by the river Chebar, and each one went straight ahead. So Ezekiel has had two encounters with these living creatures who were then identified as cherub or cherubim. It gives us a greater idea of what it means. Now remember last week we read that David said that God rode on the cherubim. Well, now we get this same image. Ezekiel sees God above the cherubim. And when God rises, the cherubim rise. And when the cherubim settle and put their wings down, God is above them. So it's this same imagery that whatever else you think about angels, however else you describe or conceive of angels, that they also seem to be not only in God's presence and around him, part of his worship, but they also appear to like carry his throne and carry his presence to particular places. I also find it interesting that these creatures with their four faces, if they do represent the four gospels, then everywhere that God appears, the story of those four gospels, or at least a representation of them, is part and parcel of the presence of God, carrying the presence of God around. Yes, ma'am.
Is there any importance to the idea that the bull is no longer mentioned, that was replaced with a cherubim's face?
I think the fact that Ezekiel takes the time to say, the faces are the same as what I saw at the river Chebar, he wants to make sure that people know that these are the same exact creatures. So there's a translation thing going on there between the word cherub and the word oxen.
Right.
But Ezekiel took the time to clear up your question and say, same creatures.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Same faces, yep. So does that kind of help us understand what these cherubim are? Mm. No, but yes, but no, but yeah. But
pretty powerful
beings, always in the presence of God, taking the presence of God around, and certainly we can see why Ezekiel fell on his face. Now, I think, Megan, it was you who asked a question last week as we continue to talk about these different creatures, different angelic beings. You asked about archangels. The fact that archangels exist is proof and evidence that there is a hierarchy in heaven. Arche, the Greek word, simply means first or primary. It's moved into the English language for words like archetype. If something is archetypal, it's the primary one or the first one. Jude 1:9 makes reference to Michael the archangel. Last week I mentioned that there's only two angels in the Bible that are named by name, Michael and Gabriel. Actually, the word Michael, Michael, means warrior of God. And Gabriel means who is like God. So even as God was assigning them names, he was giving them names that redounded back to his glory. You'll be my warrior, and you'll be the one who every time people see you, they'll say, who's like God? So Jude 1:9, actually there is only one chapter in Jude, but verse 9 of Jude says, but Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, the Lord rebuke you. Now that's interesting. We'll get into it later, hopefully, as we talk about the demonology stuff. But my point for the moment is, here is Michael, who is a warrior of God, who is referred to as an archangel, a chief angel. Revelation 12:7-8, there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels were waging war with the dragon. And the dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough, and there was no place to be found for them in heaven. So now you have two different groups, two different camps. You've got Satan and his angels, but they're being countered by Michael and his angels. Well, that shows you then that Michael is archangel, chief captain angel. The same way that Satan has his followers and his army, Michael has his army who are assigned to his leadership. 1 Thessalonians 4:16, of course, is the verse about us being caught away, for the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of, and at that point, translators will put in different articles. I believe the King James says with the voice of an archangel. New American Standard says with the voice of the archangel. And with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. There's a couple different ways to understand that. It might be that it is Michael that is doing the crying out, that there is Michael as an archangel. But I think, more than likely, and looking at it in the Greek text, it seems to indicate that Jesus is the one calling, and since he is the chief of all the angels, he's being referred to there as an archangel, or as the chief of the angels. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, that he is the chief of all the angels. If it turns out that he's coming back with Michael, and Michael does cry out, oh, I don't care, that's okay, long as I go. I'm good with either one. But I think that's the direct reference. And of course, in Daniel 8, 16 and 17, I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the river Ulai, and he called out and he said, Gabriel, so there's an angel being named by name, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he came near to me where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face, and he said to me, Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the end of time. So in this instance, Gabriel is acting very much like a messenger, but even beyond just being a messenger of God, he's being sent to explain a vision, to clarify a vision. So not only does this show comprehension and intelligence and communication, but also a revelatory ability. Here you have an angel explaining in advance what's going to happen, very much like Gabriel speaking to Mary and later to Joseph and explaining, this is what's going to happen. Prophetically, this is what's coming. You're going to have a child, and the thing that's in you is going to be of the Holy Spirit, and you're going to call his name Jesus. And so he's carrying prophetic messages and then also carrying understanding. He's going to explain the message. Daniel 9:21, while I was still speaking in prayer, then the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in a vision previously, came to me in my extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering. So as God continued to communicate to Daniel, he kept sending Gabriel. And then as I just mentioned, Luke 1:19, this is Zechariah in the temple. This is when the angel comes and tells him that he's going to have a son and they're going to name him John, which Zechariah doesn't like the idea of because he says, there's nobody in my family named that. So why would we do that? The angel answered him and said, I am Gabriel who stands in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. That's interesting. I am Gabriel, whose name means who is like God, and I stand in the presence of God. So he added that like an identifier. I'm one of God's holy angels. I stand in his very presence. Who do you think you're talking to?
Don't you sass me.
What? Is that how you read it?
Yeah, don't you sass me.
Yeah, don't you sass me. If I say his name's John, and oh yeah, you don't get to talk. Which is exactly what happened. Luke 1:26, now in the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city in Galilee called Nazareth. That was the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy, as she was pregnant with John the Baptist, and then her cousin Mary was told that she was going to be pregnant and have Jesus. And it was Gabriel that's bringing all these messages, and you'll notice, again, it says he was sent from God. Which is why he could say, I stand in the presence of God. That's who I am. That's what I do. Turn to Daniel 10 now. If you're still in Ezekiel, just keep going a little bit. Turn to Daniel 10. And we will start in verse 10. He has just seen a terrifying vision. In those days, I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks. We read in verse 2. I did not eat any tasty food, nor did meat or wine enter my mouth. That's verse 3. On the 24th day of the first month, when I was by the bank of the great river, that is the river Tigris, I lifted my eyes, and behold, there was a man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz. His body was also like beryl, and his face had the appearance of lightning, and his eyes were like flaming torches, and his arms and his feet had the gleam of polished bronze, and the sound of his words were like the sound of a tumult. Does that sound familiar at all? Now I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, while the men who were with me did not see the vision, because God can reveal himself to whoever he wants. Nevertheless, a great dread fell on them, so that they ran away and hid themselves. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me, for my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength, but I heard the sound of his words. And as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face with my face to the ground. Now we're at verse 10 where I said we were going to start. I backed up a little, as you may have noticed. Then behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. I know we're talking about angels, but I just have to point out, because it's the second time we've seen it. We saw it in Ezekiel. We see it here. When people encounter the real God, they fall on their face. They fall forward on their face. They don't fall backward like they're slain in the spirit. But then you'll notice what the Spirit of God does. The Spirit of God lifts them up. They naturally fall down like dead men because they're in the presence of the true, holy, almighty God. So they get on their face in the dust in front of him, but the Spirit of God picks them up and put Daniel on his hands and knees. And he said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem. That's interesting language. Wouldn't you love to hear that? O Megan, girl of high esteem. Understand these words that I'm about to tell you, and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. When he had spoken this word to me, I stood trembling. And he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia. Kings plural, because Medo-Persia had two different kings, Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. Eventually the Persian kingdom became more powerful than the Median kingdom, and so they were kind of engulfed into the larger Persian kingdom. But notice that this angel, who is Gabriel, comes and says to Daniel, I heard your prayer 21 days ago. I was dispatched to come to you. But there is this war in the heavenlies. This is probably a good brief introduction to some of the things we'll start talking about in demonology in the weeks to come, that there are wars that go on in the heavens, and that Gabriel was withstood by a demonic force who he identifies as the king of Persia, because the Persian king was in fact demonically inspired, demonically possessed. And the kingdoms of this world, we're told, are under the headship of Satan, which is why he's called the prince of the power of the air, which is why he could take Jesus up onto a high mountain, show him all the kingdoms of the earth and say, I'll give you all these if you just bow down to me. And Jesus didn't say, they're not yours to give, because they were. The kingdoms of this world were under his domain. And so Gabriel says, I had to have Michael, one of the chief princes. That's why we're looking at this. Again, archangel, chief prince. This shows leadership. This shows that there's a hierarchy in heaven. So Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I'd been left there with the kings of Persia. Now I've come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. When he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. And behold, one who resembled a human being was touching my lips. And then I opened my mouth and spoke and said to him who was standing before me, O my Lord, as a result of the vision anguish has come upon me, and I have retained no strength. For how can such a servant of my Lord talk with such as my Lord? As for me, there remains just now no strength in me, nor has any breath been left in me. Then this one, with a human appearance, touched me again and strengthened me. And he said, O man of high esteem, do not be afraid. Peace be with you. Take courage and be courageous. Now, as soon as he spoke to me, I received strength and said, may my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. This is very similar to what we read last week out of Isaiah. One thing that Isaiah recognized immediately was that he was a man of unclean lips, and he dwelt among a people of unclean lips. And once you come in contact with the glory of the genuine, holy, almighty God, you shut up. You cover your mouth. You don't start talking. You don't start opinionating. And in order to even speak to such a high and holy one, he has to give you the ability. He has to give you the wherewithal. He even has to give you the permission. Whether it was an angel taking a coal from a fire, touching Isaiah's lips and saying, see, this has touched your lips, your sins are forgiven. Now Isaiah can speak when the question goes out, who shall go for us? Isaiah says, here am I, send me. But not until that happened, where his lips were cleansed so that he could speak to God. Same thing that's happening here to Daniel. He can't even speak. He's so overwhelmed. But the one who looks like a man, the indication being that this could be a Christophany with the description that was given earlier here of him, comes and gives him the ability to speak. Daniel says, how can someone like me speak to someone like you? We need to remember that. We need to remember that when we think about what appropriate reverence is. If indeed the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We have to remember the kind of God we're talking to and the kind of God we're dealing with. And we have to remember that Christ has had this kind of glory since before forever. When he was leaving the planet in his high priestly prayer, one of the things that he said was, now return me to the glory that I had with you before the worlds were formed. So all these descriptions that we're hearing of the cherubim and God on his throne with the rainbows around him, and sea of glass, all the different descriptions of his throne room and stuff, that's Christ's living room. That's his home. That's what he's used to. And yet he was here on the planet and let men speak all kinds of evil against him and let people mock him and spit on him and beat him and treat him horribly. You can see why he would say, take me back to the glory that I had. Well, when he shows up in the Old Testament, any sort of Christophany, any kind of theophany, even an angelic appearance, human beings know enough to shut up and get down, which you don't see much of these days because we've become so familiar with God and so familiar with Christ and the idea of angels that we're told if an angel shows up, tell him what you want. You know, start talking. If Jesus shows up, give him your list of demands.
The reason Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, that what comes out of the mouth of man defiles him.
That's right. It's not what goes into a man's mouth that defiles him, it's what comes out. Mm-hmm. So the one with a human appearance touched me again and he strengthened me. And then he said, O man of high esteem, don't be afraid. Peace be with you, take courage, be courageous. Now as soon as he spoke to me, I received strength. And said, may my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And then he said, do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Grisha is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. That's just wonderful and mysterious language. And there is this war in the heavenlies, and once they go back, join Michael in the fight, take the prince of Persia out of the way, that creates a vacuum into which comes the prince of Grisha, and Alexander the Great hits the planet. We'll get into that more as we talk more demonology, but what I wanted you to see there was Michael is an archangel. He is a protector of Israel. He's the prince of the people of Israel. And he has his own angels, and he is an archangel. He is a captain of the angels. Angels appear all through the Bible, and there appear to be lots and lots of them. Revelation 5:11 says, "I looked, and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne and the living creatures." Oh, there's those guys again. The four-headed cherubim. And the living creatures and the elders. And the number of them was Murios, Murios in the Greek. It's a word that has been translated right into the English language as myriad. If you're talking about a large, uncountable number, you'll resort to myriad. It's a myriad. I don't know how many. Well, he said it was myriad of myriads, Murios, Murios, and thousands of thousands. So I'm going to go with the angelic host as a pretty large group. Deuteronomy 33:1-2 says this. Now this is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the sons of Israel before his death. He said, "The Lord came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran, and he came from the midst of 10,000 holy ones. And at his right hand, there was flashing lightning for them." Okay, so we're getting some consistency in the imagery now. There's burning coals, and there's altars, and there's precious jewels, and there's flames of fire, and there's flashes of lightnings. And that God comes from his 10,000s of holy ones. So God, for his own reasons, for his own purposes, God who can do whatever he wants to do, created myriads of angelic beings and angelic creatures. And they are around him and in his presence. In other words, I think we could safely say, he doesn't need you. He's perfectly fine in his myriads of angels who worship him constantly. What a tremendous work of grace it is that he's going to allow you to come be part of that throng. And I can't wait to listen to them sing. That's going to be a pretty magnificent chorus. Hebrews 12:22-24 says that that's what we're going to join. "But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels," same group, "to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven." I like that language. When we get there and participate in the New Jerusalem or in the heavenly estate, when we get there, we're going to find that our names were already enrolled, yes, in the Lamb's Book of Life. And what are we going to find there? That we're part of the church of the firstborn, because we've been born again. And we're going to be there with the myriads of angels and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. I like the King James phrase, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. And to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks better than the blood of Abel. So again, there's this huge mass of angels. There's lots of them. Myriad of them. And what are they doing? Well, one of the things that they do is they act as guardians. They run to and fro in God's creation, not only bringing messages, but protecting his people and accomplishing his will. Daniel 6:22. Daniel was in the lion's den. You probably know the story. Wouldn't do things Nebuchadnezzar's way. Okay, then into the lion's den. And then they come the next day and Daniel's fine. And he says, "My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouths. And they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. And also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime." So it wasn't just he shut the lion's mouth. He said he sent an angel who shut the lion's mouth. Which is why sometimes in paintings of Daniel in the lion's den, you'll see an extra character there, an angel standing between Daniel and the lions. And the lions all have their mouths shut and they're laying down and Daniel's safe. Why? Because God sent an angel to protect him. Psalm 91:11-12. Satan even quotes this one to Jesus. But it says, "For he will give his angels charge concerning you to guard you in all your ways. They will bear you up in their hands that you do not strike your foot against a stone." Now, the fact that Satan applied that to Jesus gives us some idea that this was probably a messianic psalm to begin with. But the idea, again, is that angels were going to bear Jesus up to protect him while he was on the planet, because this is part of the job of angels. They are guardians. Matthew 18, 10 and 11, Jesus speaking says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones." He's talking about the children. "For I say to you that their angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost." Very much like Gabriel saying, "I'm Gabriel, I stand in the presence of God." He says, don't despise these little ones. And remember, their angels constantly see the face of God. Interesting language. This, by the way, is the verse from which we get the notion of guardian angels, and that every child has a guardian angel. I would like a whole bunch of them. By the way, sometimes some people got a whole bunch of them. In Acts 12, 7 to 11, we'll get to a bunch of them in just a minute. You all can be turning to 2 Kings. Turn there. I'm going to read from Acts 12, verses 7 to 11. "On the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains." So he's got two soldiers, one on either side of him, and he's bound with chains to both of them. "And there were guards in front of the door, and they were keeping watch over the prison." So Peter is really guarded and chained and connected to guards. "And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell, and he struck Peter's side to wake him up." I like the idea that there was an angel in the cell and Peter was out like a light, and that the angel had to jostle him and say, "Wake up, I'm here. Angel." "And he said to him, 'Get up quickly.' And his chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, 'Gird yourself, put on your sandals.' And he did so. And the angel said to him, 'Wrap your cloak around you and follow me.' And he went out and continued to follow. And he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but he thought he was seeing a vision." He'd been asleep. He didn't know if he was dreaming. He didn't. I mean, he's chained to two guards, and he's in a cell, and there's a guard on the cell, and then he's jostled, and an angel says, "Come with me." His chains fall off. "Get your cloak." He grabs his cloak. Everybody else is out, and he walks out of the jail following an angel. So he's still not sure whether this is real or a vision or what's going on. "And when they had passed the first and the second guard," which is just funny, "they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself." It's good to have an angel with you. "So now the iron gate opens by itself, and they went out, and they went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. And when Peter came to himself," kind of shook it off and went, "Hey, here I am," he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." So sometimes angels intercede and act as guardians for God's people. I asked you to turn to 2 Kings 6 just because I really like this passage. I want you to see it with your own eyes. This is Elisha and his servant, and they're surrounded, and they're in trouble. "Now when the attendant of the man of God," this is verse 15, 2 Kings 6, verse 15, "when the attendant of the man of God had risen early and gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?' So he answered, 'Do not fear, for those that are with us are more than those who are with them.'" Okay, so the servant looks around and sees nothing but opposing army circling the city. Well, then we're doomed. We're dead. And Elisha says, "Don't worry, we have more on our side." Begging the question, where? Where would they be? "And Elisha prayed and said, 'O Lord, I pray that you will open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when they came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Strike this people with blindness, I pray." So God struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Then Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he brought them to Samaria. Took them to a completely different place. So in this instance, you've got Elisha, and God sent an entire army of angels and horses and chariots of fire to surround Elisha and protect him, because he was the prophet of God on the planet at the time. So sometimes God sends one angel to get Peter out of there. Sometimes he sends armies with chariots of fire to get Elisha out of there. Psalm 34:7 says, "The angel of the Lord encamps around those that fear him and rescues them." Oh, well, that's really good news, because here we have an example of it. We just saw that there was the army of the Lord surrounding Elisha, and David says the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues them. Have you ever had a circumstance in your life where something happened really inexplicable, that when it was over, your blood starts pumping and the adrenaline's running and you're just breathing heavy and you go, whoo, that was close. Whoa, man, if I hadn't looked up right then. Or boy, I don't even know why I turned the wheel left just then, but oh man, if I hadn't. Or somebody comes sweeping in the wrong way and just about sideswipes you and would have taken you out completely, and within inches, and you're okay and you're all right. And you think, how did that happen? How am I okay right now? I should be roadkill at this moment. This should not. That's God's hand of providence making sure that you're safe. That's God taking care of you. "Because I have the authority of the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he rescues them." And I believe that as much today as the day when David wrote it. 2 Kings 19:35. I would also have to say, be cautious of angels. Because then it happened that night that an angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men arose early in the morning, behold, all of them were dead. So the same angel of the Lord that encamps around those who fear him, the same angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of Assyria. That is a powerful angel. In a single night, 185,000, it's good to know they're on your side. You don't want to be against that kind of power. Let's talk about how powerful they are. Psalm 103:20 says, "Bless the Lord, you his angels, mighty in strength, who perform his word, obeying the voice of his word." So David, in this moment, wants you to know that these angels are described. It's characteristic of them that they are mighty in strength. But that's also picked up in the New Testament. Ephesians 1, 18 to 21, "I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened, so that you will know what is the hope of his calling and what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, and what is the surpassing greatness of his power toward us who believe. These are in accordance with the working of the strength of his might, which he brought about in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule." Now we're talking about heavenly dominions. "Christ sits above all rule and all authority and power and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the age to come." And so the categories of angelic beings, I think this language refers both to the holy angels and the fallen angels, that Christ is far above every rule, every authority, every power, every dominion. That's the way these groups are labeled. And so when the Word of God labels groups of angels as rulers and authorities and powers and dominions, then you know that they have a tremendous amount of strength. Turn to 2 Peter 2. Let's all look at this one. Am I overwhelming you yet? I'm just trying to show you lots of biblical information about angels. This is very, very interesting language. 2 Peter 2, we're going to start in verse 4. This is actually a condemnation of the godless people. And it's going to play into the demonology stuff that we're going to talk about in the weeks to come. But you can't talk about angels without touching on some of this stuff. 2 Peter 2, starting at verse 4. Everybody there? For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, this is kind of what you were asking about earlier, Josiah. By the way, Josiah asked a good question. He came in and he sat down and he said, I want to ask a pre-question before we get started. He said, the angels that are called the elect angels, do they have the capacity or the ability to fall and sin, since we know that some angels did fall? And that's a very good question, and we're not told exactly in the Bible. So what I told him was, my best understanding of it is, since they are referred to as holy angels, I assume that no, they cannot fall and that they cannot sin. In fact, I would not put it past a completely sovereign God to know exactly, the same way that he knows the exact number of Gentiles that are going to be brought in. You read about that in Romans 11, when the fullness of the number of Gentiles has come in, then all Israel will be saved, because God knows exactly what he's doing to the minutia, to the detail. I'm willing to believe that he made a certain number of angels with the capacity to fall, because that served his greater purpose, the glorification of his Son. And that those are the ones that had the capability to fall, and they did fall. The others are the elect angels, and they could not fall, nor are they going to. And so they could be referred to as the holy angels. But here, Peter makes this incredible comment, because one of the realities of the difference between human beings and angels is that there are fallen angels and there are fallen humans. And Christ took on flesh so that he could redeem fallen humans, but he never took on an angelic form in order to redeem fallen angels. So, for if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness, reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly? And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter? And if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men? For by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. If all that's true, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires and despise authority. They are daring, self-willed. They do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties. Whereas angels, who are greater in might and power, do not bring a reviling judgment against them before the Lord. So here even Peter takes the time to say that angels are greater in might and power than human beings are, and yet human beings in their ignorance are willing to revile angelic majesty. In other words, he compared us to Sodom. He compared human beings to the world before the flood. And he said that the ancient world and Sodom and people today have no fear of God and have no sense of angelic majesty, whatever that means, that there is a holiness, there is a righteousness to heavenly things. and human beings revile it because they are daring and self-willed and don't know enough to tremble because they have corrupt desires and they despise authority. That describes human beings pretty well. But it says that angels are more powerful than humans. Hebrews 2:7, speaking of Christ, it says, "You have made him for a little while lower than the angels, but you have crowned him with glory and honor and have appointed him over the works of your hands." So when Christ was in his incarnation, he was, just like humans, a little lower than the angels. I think that's the same thing Peter was getting at. That angels, holy angels, the angels that didn't leave their first estate, who aren't kept in chains of darkness, they are in a better state than you and I are right now. Here, I'll prove it to you. Jamie, do you have access to the throne room of God to stand face to face and look God in the eye? No! But the angels do. Okay, well, that gives them superior access. That gives them a higher level of holiness. It also gives them a sense of reality that we don't have because we live in this physical state where God is invisible to us. And yet they can see him. They can describe his form. They know what he's like. So Jesus, in order to become human, became a little lower than the angels. All right, now I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the phrase, the angel of the Lord, but let's just stop right there and pick it up next week because that's an hour and I don't want to keep you too terribly late. But we're going to talk about the specific phrase, the angel of the Lord, because that phraseology appears in the Old Testament several times and there are examples of the language where it's clear that this is a theophany. And there is one that is an obvious Christophany. And so even God, when he appears in a human form, a recognizable human form, Christ in pre-incarnate appearances are also called in the Bible angel of the Lord. So when you read the word angel, and as you think about the angelic host, and as you think about the messengers of God, recognize that sometimes they are actually angels. Sometimes they're Gabriel, sometimes they're Michael. Sometimes they're Christ himself. And there are examples of that that are really clear. But that's going to be a half hour just to kind of get that all laid out. So let's stop there. We'll pick up there next week. And then we'll probably wrap up angelology and transition into demonology next week and go from there. Fair enough?
Yes. We haven't gotten into how angels change their form.
I don't think we know. I don't think the Bible tells us the process of changing their form.
You know they do, don't they?
But we know that they do. Yeah, but even that we'll get into when Abraham sees three men. But his reaction to the three men is pretty remarkable, so we got to look at that. And one of those three men turns out to be the Lord himself. So we'll get into that. You shook your head, Josiah.
It's crazy.
But it's wonderful, isn't
yes.
it? Yeah. And by the way, let me just put this caveat, this PS, this addendum. Let me just tack this on to the end. Let me keep talking. Let me, as a what?
A codicil.
A codicil. Oh, I like that word a lot. Yeah. All I heard was the cod part, and I thought you were making a fish joke. I didn't know where we were going. I just... A lot of what we read tonight, the Ezekiel stuff, even the Elisha stuff, chariots of fire, which, by the way, Elijah, when he was taken up into a chariot of fire. Not surprising, then, that Elisha, his servant, would see chariots of fire. He had already been prepared to see these things. But these are really wonderful and amazing and fantastical and difficult to imagine things for people like us who spend our days in the dirt and dust of this planet. It's hard for us physical, time-bound beings to think about stuff like this. And I know some people who say, well, I would believe if God would just show me, you know, if an angel showed up in my bedroom, then I would believe. And of course, I argue, no, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. If God doesn't give you the faith to believe, you won't believe. You already have someone who rose from the dead, who sailed off into the blue, and you don't believe him. And he's the one who said, they have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. And so he has already testified to the validity of the Bible, and people don't believe that. So I start and I end all the time with Christ. It always comes back to Christ. Is Christ a believable eyewitness? Is Christ a valid testimony to the heavenly reality? And he validated his own testimony when he rose from the dead. And when we were doing Christology, we took the time to show the evidences that he in fact rose from the dead. So if he rose from the dead and he is the Son of God and he talks about angels and describes the heavenly estate, then it goes back to that. If you can settle that question, if you can settle who Christ is, and if you can settle what he did, and if you can settle that he has the authority, then that gives authority to the whole of the Bible. And even in those places where you're reading about multi-winged, four-faced cherubim who are carrying the throne of God around and you can't begin to fathom it, just know that it's right here in this word that Jesus himself validated. And so if he, the one who gave credibility to his own claims, the one who is not only the Son of God but proved it, if he says this is true, then I got to go with this is true. And it makes heaven all the more exciting. No matter how I imagine the cherubim, I'm sure when we see them, we're going to go, oh, like that. I see. I had no idea. Because it's just so hard for us to imagine. By the way, I didn't mention this when we were talking about Ezekiel, but you'll notice that wherever they went, this little detail, wherever they went, they went straight. Whatever direction they went in, they went straight in that direction, which is a marvelous little detail that shows that there's no variation, no shadow of turning, that there's nothing in them that goes, oh, adjust that, we're not going quite right. There's no bend in the path. They know where they're going, they know what they're doing, and when they set out to do it, they go straight to it. I like that kind of purposeful, righteous surety, because I am all unrighteous imperfection, and there are all kinds of bends and twists in the road of my life. I like knowing that when God goes somewhere, and the Spirit of God is going anywhere, that they go out ahead. And the wheels that are eyes within eyes within eyes, I think is emblematic of the fact that they see everything. They see it all. They know what's going on. They have perfect knowledge of what's happening as the Spirit of God has this omniscience of what's going on in the world. And if he has that kind of perfect power and perfect omniscience, then he can decide where he's going and go straight there without having to bend or turn or adjust in the least. And I like that. So, a couple little extra details there. I think we're done.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson in systematic theology. Please join us next week and be sure to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org.